You're listening to Fuller Curated, a podcast of the best conversations happening at Fuller.
Themes that we're talking about, justice, grace, and law, are in the Bible set in a context of a relationship. And so in this first session with you, I want to talk about that relationship because that relationship really recharacterizes and redefines what we might mean by justice, grace, or law. That relationship is open-ended. It is contested, it is ongoing, it is life or death, it is risky, and it is dialogical. Well, that's all the words I could think of. And what I'm going to do is to talk about four texts. Probably these texts are familiar to you, but I thought to arrange them around these topics might be important, and then I will make some expository comments about that. The first text that I want to talk about, and I think the most important text in the Old Testament for our theme, is in Hosea 2. You may recall that Hosea 2 is a long poetic text that is divided into two parts. The first part is Yahweh's anger that leads to litigation and divorce from Israel, the partner. It's all patriarchal language, so I want you to know I know that. And there's a very harsh therefore, and there's a second harsh therefore. And then when you get to the third therefore in verse 14, therefore I will woo you and bring you into the wilderness and transform the valley of trouble into the door of hope. And so the last half of the text is about remarriage and loving again, and we are not told how we got there. But we did get there, and in that second half, you can see this relationship moving in a very strange way when Yahweh makes marital vows to Israel. I will take you for my wife forever. I will take you in righteousness, in justice, in steadfast love, in mercy, and in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. Now, I want to linger over those five words because those five words sum up everything I have to say about our topic for these days together. Justice, righteousness, steadfast love, faithfulness, and mercy, they are the core of covenantal relationality, and they are all rough synonyms, I think. They belong to the same semantic field, so that justice and righteousness have to do with a viable socioeconomic political order. Steadfast love and faithfulness have to do with the intimacy that will sustain public institutions. And the fifth term, compassion, Phyllis Tribble has noticed, is like the word womb with different vowel pointing. So she translates it womb-like mother love. What this long poetic text shows, that in the wake of deep wound and indignation, Yahweh is able to do an about-face in verse 14 without any warrant or explanation. It is this unilateral reversal on the part of Yahweh that ends by saying, you shall know the Lord, you shall acknowledge the Lord, you shall come to terms with Yahweh's will for the world. So notice what this poet does. He is an artist, and what he does is to trope public reality according to the metaphor of divorce and remarriage, because the core of human life is about fidelity and betrayal and relational possibility and divine agency that lives in, with, and under political culture. It is an extraordinary thing that the Bible can articulate public order and questions of justice and law in terms of a dialogical relationship that makes a U-turn in the middle of it for the sake of vitality. The second text is that if we reach behind Hosea 2 and we reach back far enough, the text that I picked out is in Exodus 34, 6, and 7. This is after the travesty of the golden calf and the smashing of the two tablets. And then after this negotiation between Moses and Yahweh, then Moses makes this incredible declaration about who Yahweh is. And you get the word chesed twice. Then you get amunah, then you get racham. Those are the words that we already saw in Hosea 2 about steadfast righteousness and loving kindness. Added to it is hanan, graciousness, then slow to anger, and the participle forgiving. So Yahweh declares that this failed relationship can be renewed because of who Yahweh is, because Yahweh reaches out in this incredible, faithful, generous will to be with Yahweh. But as you know, as you read down into verse 7, you come to a big yet. After he's said all these wonderful things, yet, this is a fallback position, yet I will by no means clear the guilty. So it's a very strange thing, and exegetes have worked forever to try to explain this contradiction, except the relationships revolve around contradictions. And then Moses grovels and asks for forgiveness. And then Yahweh says, I will make a covenant and I will do wonders that the nations have never seen before. I will do an awesome thing with you. And Yahweh used the word awesome before we have trivialized it so that everything is awesome. So if we read forward from Hosea 2, the text I picked out is in Lamentations 3, verses 22 to 23. You know, it is a long, grieving song about the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the epicenter of meaning in the world. And the poet says, my soul is bereft, my soul is not well. My soul is bereft, and Sigon is my glory, and all that I had hoped for, my soul thinks of it and is bowed down. Gone is glory, gone is hope, gone is possible future. And then a very brief poetic pause, and then, verse 21, but this I call to mind. Israel may despair, but Israel refuses amnesia. What is remembered is that the chesed of Yahweh never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. Great is your emunah, great is your faithfulness. So three of the five terms from Hosea 2 turn up in this text as well. So they occur at the outset in Exodus 34 with a yet that qualifies. They occur in Hosea 2 with a U-turn in a failed relationship. And they occur late in grieving over Jerusalem. And the conclusion of those verses in Lamentations 3 is so Jewish. I hope. Hope is such a Jewish thing. And that is followed in the book of Lamentations by a celebration of Yahweh. You have taken up my cause. You have redeemed me. You have seen all their malice. You have heard their taunts. And then you get these petitions that Yahweh should act on our behalf, even in this season of terrible abandonment. So you can see in all these three texts, an early text, a prophetic text, and a late text, that this relationship is unsettled and it is open and it is urgent because everything depends upon it. And then I picked out a fourth text. I'm not sure this is so useful. Psalm 85. You are aware of those verses that says, steadfast love and faithfulness will meet, righteousness and peace will kiss each other. Faithfulness will spring up the ground, and righteousness will look down. See, you got faithfulness, righteousness, and a new term is added, shalom. So the poet can imagine a stunning convergence of all of these forces of well-being that will comprehend heaven and earth, ground and sky. And the end of the psalm says that Yahweh will give what is good and our land will increase its yield. It's the replay of Genesis 1. It is very good because the earth will flourish when the relationship is in order. So the outcome of meeting and kissing in Psalm 85 is not unlike the remarriage in Hosea 2, which you know also ends with earth and heaven and grain and wine and oil all answering each other in generativity. So I propose that these four texts provide us with some materials and a semantic field in which we are to think about justice, grace, and law. In Hosea, the relationship concerns alienation and reconciliation. In Exodus 34, it concerns violated relationship and restored covenant. In Lamentations 3, it concerns lost hope and recovered hope. And in Psalm 85, it imagines restoration that is beyond divine anger. What all of these texts show is that this relationship is not settled. It is always underway. It is incredibly dynamic and risky. And God is not a fixed point. God is not an absolute. But God is a dialogic partner who engages in risky transactions with Israel. And so it is this ongoing relationship that is definitional for justice, law, and grace. And this dynamism of a dialogic relationship is so important in a technological society that wants to empty all transactions of serious relationality. So that's the burden of it. And you can, and I will, line out justice, grace, and law in different directions. But what I want to argue is that they are all performances of the same issue. So now I want to exposit that cluster of texts, and I will do this sort of in outline form. First, what the Bible knows is that life is all about interactive relationships, which calls into question all of our comfortable essentialisms, because the relationship is open to surprise, capable of dispute and reversal and fresh initiative. And one of the sadnesses in the church is that we have sort of, in our quest for certitude, we have emptied all of the possibility of surprise. But we have to do with a living God, not with a settled God that is now immobile and in one place forever. This commitment to relationship is irreducible. I think it is right to say in the Bible that there is nothing behind it. It is what it is. It cannot be transposed into anything else. And we try to reduce it by freezing God into attributes. We try to categorize human essences by gender, race, and class. And all of our freezing and all of our categorizing turn out to be feeble in the face of this inscrutability out of which we live. And the human counterpart of this God is also inscrutable. How could we also not be inscrutable in our relationality since we take our life from this source? So the inexplicable human creature made for relationships have been mandated since Jubal and Tubal Cain, whoever they were, to imagine cities and to form societies so that our work is to imagine and it is to form. And what we know about our cities and our societies is that they are filled with ambiguity and they are destined for interaction. And it is our work as the people of God to insist on city and society as being primarily a labor of interaction. Second, these parties to the relationship, God, self, and neighbor, are variously called to fidelity. So all that vocabulary of righteousness, justice, mercy, steadfast love, and faithfulness are all about fidelity. And I can think of these marks of fidelity, that fidelity requires face-to-face address that sounds like oath-taking. Direct speech is the medium of fidelity. And I am struck, whether one thinks of litigation or whether one thinks of sacramental life and marriage, which is close to sacramental, that for whatever else we explain away in technology, you still have to appear in front of the judge. You still have to appear in front of an official. You have to make promises. You have to take vows. You have to utter words that are heard and received. So fidelity in this relationship involves making and keeping promises that are not always reliable. So God makes promises, and I know we sang about it all being reliable, but whole lots among us know it isn't always reliable. And we make promises back to God, and they are not always reliable. But our work in this relationship is to make promises and to keep promises. Fidelity in this matrix pertains to the common good, a prospect that pertains to God and to self and to neighbor, the common good that in the Bible goes under the banner of shalom. And so we sing trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy. The common good has to do with trusting and obeying in a way that none can be excluded, none can be disregarded, none can be left behind, not the widow, not the orphan, not the immigrant. Fidelity is expressed as bodily shalom. It is elemental that these words, chesed, emuna, racham, mishpat, tzedakah, can never be slotted simply as spiritual categories because they are always concerned with political, social, bodily well-being. And the line that runs from creation to covenant to incarnation is a line of materiality. So I am struck in the early recital of covenantal blessings in the tradition of Deuteronomy that the blessings have to do with functional materiality. Blessed shall you be in the city and in the field. Blessed shall be the fruit of your womb, the fruit of the ground, the fruit of your livestock, the increase of your cattle. Blessed will be your basket and your kneading bowl. City and field, urban life and agriculture, livestock, cattle, means of production, homemaking, mundane domesticity, basket, kneading bowl, coming out and going in, which may be an image for war. amazing that the church has so much tried to siphon off the materiality of fidelity into some kind of religious magic. Fidelity is grounded in unmocked holiness. This is a God who will not be mocked. And therefore the mandate is, you shall be holy as I am holy, which doesn't mean to obey the purity codes, I think, but it means not to profane life, not to reduce human life to pornographic cheapness, but to be in the neighborhood with respect and honor and deep mystery for the neighbor. Because when holiness yields to profanation, life becomes cheap and neighbors become dispensable and the common good yields to cynicism. Fidelity is the relentless practice of what Bud Wilkinson at Oklahoma used to call second effort. After the halfback was blocked, he was supposed to get up and run again for 5 yards. So fidelity is about second effort. So God makes a second effort after the golden calf. So God makes new wedding vows after the divorce. Fidelity is a resolve of loyalty that is undeterred and unimpeded by the most unbearable of circumstances. Third, if you're numbering, it's like Karl Barth, you get second 80 pages later. Sorry. Relationships require agency. They require the capacity to be the subject of active initiative-taking verbs. And in the book of Psalms, the fools that mock God do not deny the existence of God, they deny the agency of God. The fool says in his heart, God will not do evil or God will not do good. But God, as an agent, has set limits on practices that are prohibited. And it remains in this relationship for us to be pondering, what are the limits that cannot be transgressed? We have been witnessing them in Ferguson and in Baltimore. God as agent is said to be endlessly available and attentive to other parties in the relationship. So Klaus Westermann has said that the whole practice of prayer in the Old Testament is call and answer. Or even in Isaiah 65, before you call, I will answer. So much of the prayer life of Israel in the book of Psalms is a recognition that God was not attentive and that God was not available. But Israel, in such circumstance, prayed with incredible chutzpah, knowing that it was entitled in the relationship to divine availability and divine attentiveness, even if God is abusive and neglectful and had reneged on fidelity. Israel made the case for otherwise. So there is a remarkable attestation in the Old Testament that the summons of Israel did evoke the presence of Yahweh, who can finally say in Isaiah 54, right before the verse that we did in worship, "For a brief moment I did abandon you, but with great compassion I will be with you again." Agency carries with it transformative potential and capacity. God is not only present to comfort, But God's agency is in the business of restoration of all that people need in order that they may live a viable life. Fourth, I think that divine agency is hard enough. And according to Enlightenment rationality, divine agency is something of an embarrassment. But I have come to think that human agency is even more difficult. So Margaret Thatcher famously said, there is no such thing as society. And Margaret Thatcher really wanted to eliminate human agency except for the process of making money. But of course, that's not the route to the common good. So I propose that human agency in this relationship has work to do that is very much like God's agency. So human agents are to set limits on chaos. And what we have been experiencing in Baltimore is chaos. I do not mean the thugs, as Obama called them, but I mean the police who are agents of chaos. Limits must be set on chaos that is imposed from above. Human agents, like the agency of God, are to practice availability and attentiveness to the public process. And one can make a case that in the United States, Christians have been absent without leave about participation in the public process according to our baptism. Participation in the public process belongs to human relationality. And, wonder of wonders, human agents, like divine agent, have a capacity for transformative action. Faith teaches us that things do not need to stay the way they are, but it takes an investment of wise, determined human agency to create something new for the sake of the common good. Fifth, relationality means, to quote Paul, look to the interests of others. You know, in capitalist ideology, all you have to do is to look to your own interest. But the whole relationality of covenant in the Bible is to look to the interest of others. The environmental crisis reminds us that to look to the interest of others is to look to the interest of creation. Or it means to look to the interest of all of Israel, not just the power people in Israel. Or given God's preferential option for the poor, it means to look to the interest of the poor. In all three cases of creation, and Israel, or the church, and the poor, God's self-sufficiency and God's self-preoccupation are radically modified. The God of the Bible, this is extraordinary, commonplace, but extraordinary, the God of the Bible is not primarily preoccupied with God's own well-being, but with the interaction that evokes the well-being of the other and yields for God unending doxology. This reach toward the other does not constitute an abandonment of the self. So in God's reach toward the other, God does not abandon God's own self. And there is evidence at many places in the Old Testament that God's self-regard overrides God's self for the other, because God will not be mocked or trivialized or cheapened. But sixth, this reach toward the other means that the relationship out of which we get justice, grace, and law is always about othering. So the other in the Bible is the widow, the orphan, and the immigrant, those who were vulnerable and needed protection of an economic kind. So in Deuteronomy 10, God says through Moses, love the stranger, the sojourner, because you were strangers in Egypt. Or othering means to reach in Isaiah 56 to eunuchs and foreigners, for God's sake. Or even other nations in the belated texts of the prophetic tradition. And when we look into the New Testament, I suspect the most demanding and difficult and important decision made in the New Testament church was the boldness of opening the baptismal community to the Gentiles. You know, the Gentiles, those whom we found to be unclean. And God says, do not call unclean those whom I have made clean. So the mission of the church is always to be reaching to the next order of Gentiles, to the next order of people who really repel us, and we wish we didn't have to deal with them, and you wouldn't want your daughter to marry one of them. And they turn out to be our co-conspirators in the gospel, so that Paul can, in Galatians, can reach all the way back to the Abraham narrative and say, by you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And Paul says, that was the gospel beforehand, that you exist in order that all of the others may be blessed as well. So I commend to you a book by Martha Nussbaum called The Clash Within. You may know Samuel Huntington's famous book called The Coming Clash of Civilizations, in which he said the West has to go to war with the Muslims. That's what he said. So Martha Nussbaum did a long study about the Muslim-Hindu conflict in India. And what she discovered is that the conflict in India was not between Muslims and Hindus. The conflict in India was between those who could not tolerate the other and those who were open to the other and regarded the other as fellow travelers along the way. And she found people like that among the Hindus and among the Muslims. And the last page of her book, she gives us the title for the book, I Have Found That the Clash Is Not Between the West and the Muslims. I have found that the clash is within us. On the one hand, wanting to embrace the other, and on the other hand, wanting to repel the other. So she says the clash is not out there, it is in here. And I propose that this relationship means that we have to walk precisely into that clash and discover that the other is our fellow traveler in the pilgrimage of fidelity. And finally, in Hosea 2 and in Psalm 85, the outcome of this working relationship is the flourishing of creation. So I think that the Old Testament wants to make a case that how human relationships work really determines whether the environment can be healthy. That's a huge thing to say in the face of agribusiness, which is busy using up creation in order to make money. There is this remarkable oracle in Hosea 4, where the prophet says there is lying, stealing, killing, committing adultery. It's the Ten Commandments. And then the poet says, therefore, the land mourns, which is a California idiom for drought. And the birds of the air and the beasts of the field and the fish of the sea are taken away. What an extraordinary act of poetic imagination that the violation of the covenant leads to the shriveling of creation. I think that's the basis for our environmental thinking. So our work in this fast culture of instant gratification and commoditization is to linger and to see that this text about the relationship has no final reading, has no final solution, has no grand theory, has no master explanation. Rather, we are given a field for negotiation and adjudication. And in that field, we and our neighbors and Yahweh and creation and Israel and the church, we are summoned to a practice of faithful freedom that is risky and costly. And I suspect that our primary meditation is upon that risky freedom that is always seeking out new partners to whom to relate. So this is an angle of vision on justice, grace, and law. It arises from our meditation on the five big verbs. All of these verbs are about relationships. All of them are about risky lingering and being there a while and waiting in expectation. And this relationship is an agency in freedom, and it pulls us out of our comfort zone, always to be in the presence of an uneasy other. And in the end, this demanding relationship trumps all of our preferred order about morality and doctrine and everything else you can think of, all of our preferred order for the sake of new possibility. This relationship is always generating newness that is filled with joy and that is endlessly scary.
You're listening to Fuller Curated.
Mordecai famously says to Queen Esther, "For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this." At such a time as this refers to the situation depicted earlier in this story. The couriers went quickly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. In international political theory, realism believes that national and international actors are bound to pursue their self-interest and concomitant political and economic goals. This is the time-tested, unchanging nature of politics. In the view of the realist school, the incessant drive for power is rooted in human nature. The realist theory of international relations operates on the core assumption of the pervasive evil in human nature and politics. Such a view is in line with the 17th century English philosopher Thomas Hobbes's fundamental characterization of political life. Hobbes' political philosophy is rooted in the belief that human beings are inherently wicked and aggressive. In the Old Testament, nowhere is this understanding more cynically illustrated than in the book of Esther. A suspenseful account of a minority people exiled from Judah, whose existence is in peril at the hub of an imperial power, raises critical questions regarding the political nature of humans. Whether there is any theological, moral, or otherwise enlightening value to the book of Esther is a recurring question in biblical scholarship. Esther is not a conventional book in the canon. There is no indication of any religious piety or institution, such as the observance of the kashrut, the dietary law, prayer, or the temple in Jerusalem. But most importantly, it does not make a single reference to God. This ostensibly comedic narrative is intent on raising provocative questions and offering a sharp critique of the earthly power structure, particularly the moral framework of the actors driving it. Haman, the prime minister of the Persian Empire, is displeased when Mordecai won't do obeisance to him. Thus, when he learns that his ego was bruised by a man of Jewish origin, he decides to annihilate an entire people group. When Haman presents King Ahasuerus with the Maccabre scheme, the emperor and his counselors do not hesitate about the situation for a moment. A sophisticated and efficient machinery of law in the Persian Empire is at the disposal of the two unstable statesmen, and they make full usage of it in enacting the sinister plan. Ahasuerus and Haman exemplify Hobbes' and the realist school's premise on human nature and political life. Here is an instance that also exemplifies what the 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant was describing as a normative rather than an empirical condition when he wrote, "Morality is harnessed to politics through the mechanism of law. It is particularly the ambiguity and lack of clarification on Ahasuerus' moral stance on the entire situation that is deeply disturbing. He is unconcerned about choosing what is intelligibly and reasonably good for the benefit of his people and exercising his responsibility and authority as a ruler. How uncritically Ahasuerus indulges the whim of one man and seals the fate of so many lives shows the ease with which a ruler may abandon his moral obligations." Ahasuerus elicits an important reflection on the relationship among human nature, politics, and morality. In calling attention to the danger of arbitrary power, the biblical author zeroes in on the Persian emperor Ahasuerus, who is amoral in character rather than blatantly immoral. While God is not alluded to once, Ahasuerus is mentioned no less than 190 times. The character of Ahasuerus represents a fatal combination of too much power without enough moral strength to harness the former. Commentators typically view the Persian king as an egomaniacal buffoon, and he is an effective caricature of power. Ahasuerus is quite the antithesis from the predecessors of the historical Xerxes, whom scholars believe he represents. Historically, Persian rulers erected sumptuous monuments for the purpose of royal propaganda. They endeavored to promote their moral and political legitimacy by popularizing the image of a king who embraced the highest royal ideas: justice, liberty, and benevolence. In this historical novella, Ahasuerus is the ruler of every nation stretching from India to Ethiopia. In all, 127 countries, tribes, and provinces. In the 5th century BC, the Persians ruled over the largest empire that history had ever witnessed. Most historians today estimate a population of around 50 million. That means that between one half and one third of the world's population at the time lived within the borders of the Persian Empire. As a point of comparison, at the peak of its glory, the British Empire ruled over one quarter of the world's population. Even if the biblical author was exaggerating by much, Ahasuerus' historical counterpart indeed ruled over a vast territory. Iranian historian Homer Khatoutsian, in putting forward his theory of arbitrary rule, explains that the main feature of the Persian state was perpetual cycles of arbitrary rule followed by revolts supported by the whole society, dynastic change, and reemergence of the arbitrary state. After the plot, we read, the couriers went quickly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. Here, the Hebrew word navocha, translated thrown into confusion, occurs in the Bible 3 times. It also means perplexed, confounded, and agitated. In Exodus, it is translated as wandering aimlessly. It is against this backdrop of efficient legislation, communication, and mobilization that a sense of uncertainty, ignorance, and uncontrollability overwhelms the citizens of Susa. Ahasuerus' people found themselves taking part in genocide not of their own making. Ahasuerus' empire is vulnerable to the rise of terror, tyranny, xenophobia, and nationalistic fanaticism. The Book of Esther offers a valuable commentary on today's globalizing world. The phenomenon of transnational political and economic interdependence generates uncertainty and confusion similar to what the citizens of Susa experienced. Esther serves as a careful warning against the catastrophic effects of consolidation and integration of powers without a corresponding ethical framework. Hobbes and the realist school's grim assessment of human nature and politics, as well as the doctrine of the fall, support the view that the emerging world economic and political configuration needs an ethical frame that matches the informational and technological advancements. Esther tells how an ancient version of modern day's globalization, that is, integration and expansion of transnational economic production, migration, communication, and technology, went awry when control of power was concentrated in an entity that was dangerously devoid of any ethical consciousness. The 18th century French philosopher Montesquieu, in laying out his theory of the separation of powers, observed that unlike physical laws, which are instituted and sustained by God, positive laws and social institutions are created by fallible human beings who are subject to ignorance and error and hurried away by 1,000 impetuous passions. Sociologists speak of the world characteristics of today in terms of intensified interdependence between far and near nations and peoples. Naturally, not everything about globalization is sinister and dangerous. It is true that globalization's linking of distant peoples in various ways can serve to banish some sources of social conflict. Still, the likelihood of one's life being ruled by decisions made in another jurisdiction. Detached from social solidarity and desensitized humanity is among the real effects of globalization. We live in the creeping emergence of multiple loyalties, mixing of national cultures, and the transnationalization of law and politics. Much informational and technological advancement does not diminish the sense of uncontrollability, ignorance, and uncertainty. These factors are only magnified. Living in a global transnational reality means that too much information does not necessarily lead to a sense of control. One feels impotent and irrelevant not having a personal link to the other side of the globe. An abstract perception of reality aggravates ignorance and creates the false impression of knowing the other. While innovations in technology deliver the goods efficiently across the globe, poverty, repression, and insecurity continue and are even exacerbated. Whether as a college graduate competing for work or a small farmer on an island feeling powerless against the pressure of large corporations, the effects of globalization have a way of making one feel powerless, as if without decision-making power or control of one's own fate. Decisions made elsewhere alter our lives. The new kind of cosmopolitan collective consciousness in this age generates people overexposed and dulled to the reality of suffering and destruction across borders thanks to the gratuitous presentation and representation in the media, yet aptly screening out the harshness of those realities. Some political scientists observe that to a steadily increasing degree, the human race shares a common economy, a common culture, a common natural environment, common media of communication, and hence a common fate. The fact that the world is increasingly enmeshed, according to the German sociologist Ulrich Beck, means that we live in an age of shared risks. It may be summarized in the following manner. Globalization results in a power play between territorially fixed political actors, namely government, parliaments, unions, and non-territorial economic actors, that is, representatives of capital, finance, and trade, and results in the political economics of uncertainty and risk, where capital flight, capital strikes, relocation, offshore production, and outsourcing can challenge the economic security of the state and the citizens. To this phenomenon, one may add ecological and terrorist risks. Does the disconnect caused by the fundamental changes in the spatial and temporal contours of social existence brought about by globalization is real and ubiquitous? Esther's account of power barred from moral introspection serves as a chilling cautionary tale to the modern age. The emerging reality of intensified interdependence calls not only for a reinvention of national and transnational political principles, but more urgently, ethical paradigms that match the accompanying challenges of a new world order. As worldviews, products, and institutions continue jostling with one another in the global market, and as more people trade their local identities for values and lifestyles from beyond the border, we need to think critically about the new dynamics and challenges entailed by living together globally. Since we live in an age when economy and politics transcend national borders, it stands for us to ask what the scope of our ethical responsibility is now, more than ever before. The people of God have always been cosmopolitans, ever since God called Abraham out of Chaldea of Ur. Their trust in divine providence has transcended national borders. An intensified interdependence and shared risks that characterize life in the current world order propels us to the recognition that we must yield to the plurality of perceptions and experiences. A genuinely global-minded church must incorporate a diversity of principles and views. The Enlightenment movement and its heirs provide a valuable insight, particularly in this regard. Derrida argued that there can be no hospitality without a home, a place of welcome, and one in which someone is made welcome. The reconfiguration of the world requires, accordingly, a reconstruction of the practice of hospitality, an enmeshed world where the presence of plurality of voices at times challenges our ability to listen and hear, also challenges us to adopt a sophisticated cosmopolitan position. One may take a cue from Kant's definition of hospitality. The meaning of the ethical principle of hospitality is the duty to welcome strangers. Hospitality not only includes the freedom of speech, but also involves the duty to listen and to understand. As a scion of the Enlightenment project, realism believes in the objectivity of the law in relation to politics. In other words, the question of challenges faced by today's world needs to be explored in relation to political perspectives and institutions. At the same time, it is based on a grim assessment of human nature. It favors proceeding forward to a future society supported by measurable evidence and illumined by reason. It believes that sociality rests upon objectivity and reason. It wishes and hopes that reason and objectivity may lead to a moral behavior and ethical relations between political actors divorced from prejudice and passion. The comparisons between the confusion felt by the citizens of Susa and the disorientation that marks life in the 21st century highlight the fact that the certainty and conviction expressed by Mordechai is enormously puzzling. His statement cannot be justified from the standpoint of rationality or objectivity. One may assume that initially Mordechai was one of the citizens of Susa who fell into confusion. He even mourned the imminent slaughter by wearing sackcloth and spreading ashes upon himself. Yet what set Mordechai apart was his unwavering trust that relief and deliverance would arise for the Jews from another place. Cool-headedly, he makes a critical assessment of the situation. He is willing to deal critically and proactively with his reality. He approached Esther, who occupied a power position, and he wondered, who knows? After all, he thought, there was a greater force guiding the fate of his people. The entire narrative is woven through a cluster of what one may call coincidences and accidents, signaling the centrality of the belief in fate or destiny. An invisible external locus of control drives the fate of the human actors. The very title of the book, Esther, suggests that God works in hidden ways. Hence, God's covert operation in the Persian Empire has been compared to God's overt operation in the Egyptian Exodus. Therefore, as David Kleins observes, divine action and human initiatives are complementary and both indispensable for success or salvation. Mordechai's words are apt for a time such as this. Without explicitly spelling out religious language, his words exude confidence in a power that surpasses that of Ahasuerus. He is willing to trust amidst the chaos and confusion and do his share to vanquish uncertainty, fear, and death. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this. Thank you.
You have been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.